ask these questions from a different point of view and will sometimes be intentionally oppositional to uncover things that the rest of us are not seeing.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Amazon's Black Stories, where we highlight the stories of Black designers, researchers, and creative minds from all around the world. I'm your host, Justin James Lopez, and today I'm joined by Leslie Ann Noel as we talk about challenging the status quo and designing a more equitable future. Let's hear her story. Well, Leslie Ann, thank you again for joining us on this episode. As always, I wanted to just open up by allowing you the opportunity to introduce yourself to the audience here.
Thanks for this invitation, Justin. I don't even always know how to introduce myself, so I'm going to use something that's very succinct, and then maybe as we talk, we'll get more in depth.
Yeah.
I am Leslie Ann Noel, and I consider myself a design educator, design researcher, designer, and author. You know, I wear a lot of different hats, but all of these hats are related to design. I think I have a big identity around design, but of course there are other identities because we're all multi-layered. So I'm a Black woman from the Caribbean, from Trinidad and Tobago in particular. And I actually studied in Brazil. I did undergrad in industrial design in Brazil. And so these identities, Blackness, Caribbeanness, maybe even South Americanness from the Brazil experience, and these identities I also carry around with me in the work that I do. So maybe I'll stop there, and then we talk, more of my identity will come out.
Yeah, we'll pull the layers back for sure. Thank you. I really appreciate this episode and this meeting for the audience here. I was actually originally introduced to you or your work through reading the Black Experience in Design, the book, and all of these things will be linked for anyone. Don't leave right just yet. After that, I was like, well, I wonder what else. And then I saw the Design Social Change, your book, Design Social Change, but it wasn't out yet, actually. So I had pre-ordered it and then I forgot about it. And then one day it just popped up on my doorstep and I was like, oh, I've been waiting for this. So I read it, which I absolutely love. And the cooking metaphor, all of it was absolutely amazing. That will make sense to the audience later when they read it. And then I was like, you know what? I want to talk to her.
Yay.
And in my head, I'm like, I wonder how I would do that. And I was like, oh, I have an entire podcast that I can invite her to. So that's how we got here. Let's step back. What is the core theme and what was the inspiration for that?
So this is also going to be a multi-layered answer, but the big theme is about people understanding that the world isn't just one thing that is fixed, or the world doesn't happen to us. We happen to the world too. And so we can actually design the worlds that we want. So I guess that's maybe the big, big theme that I'm asking people to question the world around them and dream of a different world, or dream of the world that meets their needs, and then figure out how they're going to take some action through design. And it could be big action, small action. But the big idea or the takeaway I want people to have is that I want people to feel energized after they've read the book and say, you know, I'm going to do X, Y, Z. And, you know, it has actually happened a little bit where, like, my mother's becoming famous because I talk about this, right? But my mother read an early draft of the book before it was published. And then she called me and she said, okay, I think now I'm going to reach out to the school. She lives like within walking distance of a school. And she says, I'm going to reach out to the school and work with the children and see what they want to change in the world. And so tied to your question as well, what was the inspiration for this book? I did work with children during my PhD work, my doctoral work. I created a design camp for children where I worked with them for 3 weeks and encouraged them every week to ask bigger and bigger questions. And they wouldn't have heard this language that I was asking them to challenge the world. But that really is what I was doing, where I worked in a pretty rural community in Trinidad, where I'm from. And the first week asked the children to think about the things that questions they had about play. So first we talked about the rights of the child and human rights and stuff like that. And then I invited them to think about play and the ways that they played and what rights they wanted to have access to. And I don't remember the exact questions that I gave them, but the first week was really about them questioning that smaller space around them. And then the second week, it got a little bit bigger where they had to focus on their school and they had to talk about the things in the school that they wanted to change. And then the third week, we got bigger and they had to think about the community that they lived in and what were the things that they wanted to change. And what I think is really important from a design perspective is that, you know, so if this was work maybe somewhere else in the social sciences, we'd be writing down what are the things that people want to change, and maybe that would be where the research would end.
Yeah.
But designers don't work like that, right?
Yeah.
Because we first think about the things that need to change, and then we design them. And so in that workshop with these children, and this might sound like banal design to some people, but I just thought it was so empowering that they were able to clearly articulate the things that needed to change. And then they could draw something and say, well, this is the thing that's going to resolve the problems that I have, mm-hmm. right? And some of the things that they talked about are kind of funny.
Yeah.
I tell this story often, but I still think it's funny every time I tell it. The school had a lot of mango trees and the children said, well, that's the problem. How could that be the problem? Yeah. And, you know, the problem was actually related to the kinds of rules related to the mango trees. So they couldn't climb them. They couldn't pick the fruit. And then when they moved to the bigger space of their town, I thought the way that they wanted to address some of the issues that they thought were important, I thought they were really big ideas for children who were between 8 and 12, you know, where they talked about, okay, well, actually, we don't have enough tourism in our town, or there are no jobs, so let's create this party bus so that people know that this is the town to come to, and then they could spend a little bit of money and everybody gets happy. You know, so I've been thinking about that maybe for the last 5 years. And when I got the opportunity then to write a book about design, and a book about design that couldn't really be about design, because my book is part of a series, mm-hmm. and it's not a series of like graphic design textbooks or industrial design textbooks. It is a series of books about design, but outside of design, mm-hmm. you know, like design in the real world. So when I got that invitation to create a book around that kind of theme, you know, design outside of the world of design, I thought, okay, well, I've been excited hearing people designing the worlds that they want. So maybe that's the theme that I'm going to come up with.
That's such a wonderful program, right? To start early with children and trying to understand. It really almost takes you back to the beginner's mind and understanding, while some of it, you know, it might seem so silly what we think are our problems, but you think about it as we get older, that child that thought these silly things were the bigger problem, they just become adults that focus on silly things that they think are the bigger problem. And I think the issue is this concept of not really applying the design thinking to problem solving. And you discuss this pretty aptly in your book of when you're looking through the perspective of problem solving, starting with understanding the problem space and really, really identifying what the problem is and like, what is that framework? Because that's the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And my question, I guess, here is, where did that start for you? Because we talk about like post-PhD, but like, let's take it all the way back to when you were younger. Where did this passion for kind of design thinking, where is that rooted for you?
I would say that I've been in design my whole life. And nobody believes that when I say that, you know, because you know, there are always these programs where people are saying, oh my goodness, we need more people of color in design, blah, blah, blah. And then I show up and I say, well, actually, I think I've been a designer since I was five. Maybe not since I was five, but you know, there is design all around us in ways that maybe we don't always see. So I'm from Trinidad and Tobago, and we have Carnival. And so it means that actually everybody is designing from very young, because every school child has to design a Carnival costume. And there are other things that we do in design. But I would actually say, yeah, I've been in design forever, and maybe looking at different questions in design. Mm-hmm. So I clearly remember sixth grade design classes and seventh grade and eighth grade, and I never stopped. I always thought I would have been in design, but where specifically in design has changed over the years. So I thought some years that I would have been a photographer. My first job was in advertising, or maybe my second job. Actually, my first job was in a textile design, a batik mm-hmm. company. So I've always been in different areas of design, but the kinds of questions that I was asking were different, because maybe I was more involved at first in fashion or in product design. You know, if you're thinking about Carnival, that's related to performance. And so all of these different kinds of questions, whereas now I think I am very firmly located in the world of social design, where I am always asking questions that are somehow related to equity and better conditions of life for people in everywhere.
Yeah, I've noticed that your work tends to emphasize on the importance of like kind of this critical reflection, I think from the individual perspective and the collective perspective as well. Mm-hmm. How do you think designers, all designers, not just the ones with the title, to your point of the five-year-old Leslie Ann, how do you think designers can practice this effectively to create more impactful and equitable work?
One thing that I'd encourage other designers to do is to remember that it's our responsibility to ask questions, to look for difficult questions, to see where there is inequity. Mm-hmm. And figure out, are we doing anything to address this? Are we doing anything that somehow props up these unfair systems? And, you know, sometimes people say, well, okay, that's not our job as designers. But sometimes the things that we do can perpetuate systems of inequity. And then there is just also the role that we play in bringing awareness to issues that other people might not see.
Yeah.
I think designers have played a good role in making people very aware of problems related to access, disability, you know, like certain things around access. I think we've made people aware of this issue. And so, you know, that's some of the work that we do. You know, we bring awareness to issues of inequity and injustice, and we have to ensure that our design isn't actually perpetuating these phenomena. So in one of the classes that I teach, and this class actually influences what I've written in this recent book, Design Social Change. Very early on in the semester, we talk about what is oppression. And oppression is, you know, you could think of oppression as a very kind of like a physical thing where somebody's pushing somebody down. Mm-hmm. And we talk about that a little bit in class, you know, and if oppression is this phenomenon of people being pushed down, how then in the products or systems or services, you know, that we design, are people somehow being pushed down? Or how are we somehow kind of making it possible then for people to continue to be pushed down?
Yeah.
And so if we take that kind of lens, we could think about, oh, is it that our design is somehow excluding people who can't? I'll just give an example. Like, I don't hear very well. So, you know, maybe someone might be designing something that doesn't help people who don't hear well. Mm-hmm. And somehow we're then kind of playing a role in pushing down that group of people in society. And, you know, I've found that when I talk about that whole phenomenon of pushing people down and encouraging students to see where are people being pushed down, I found that it has made it easy actually for them to start to figure out, oh, these are some things that we need to address. And these are some changes that we can try to make through design or, you know, with other people.
That's a wonderful perspective to take. And I think I recall reading a part, and sorry if I butchered this, but I remember one part that really stuck with me was challenging yourself to design oppression out of the work and equity into the work.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting is because to your point earlier, that idea of designers saying, well, that's not our job as designers, but it is a design problem. And that's, I think, a really interesting perspective. And I find like my life has always been, I guess I could be described as a contrarian in many ways where like, regardless of the perspective, I always try to look at a different way to see it, the problem or just the statement. So when I heard you say that, my initial thought, literally, I was like, well, what I would say to those people is, it may not be your job, right? But it is a design problem. And as designers, we're uniquely positioned to solve that problem.
Yes.
And I guess my question here is, we talked about like where the design thinking and where this kind of focus started way back to five-year-old Leslie Ann, but you're so passionate about this concept of equity versus oppression or oppression versus privilege and how to create equitable spaces. Where was that triggered in your life? Like, where did that rise up in your life?
Okay. So actually before that, I'm going to say as designers, we are well poised to propose solutions, possibly, you know, sometimes we can't.
Yeah.
But we're also well poised to listen in a way that maybe sometimes other people can't. And also to share information and knowledge in ways that other people can't. Sometimes our job is about solution finding. Sometimes our job is about problem finding, which is a little different to finding the solution, because that's actually something we do pretty well as designers. We find different problems to focus on. Sometimes our job is about communicating with other people. And, you know, so there are many different roles we could be playing in supporting people on this journey. But the question of where did this interest in equity come? That's an interesting question. It probably came at different times in different ways. And so very early on, I'm going to go way back, almost a five-year-old Leslie Ann, but not quite that young. But my mom was in like a feminist social group, I suppose. Actually, the name is Housewives Association of Trinidad and Tobago. And, you know, I remember going to those meetings as a child, and I don't even remember what they talked about, but it means that I grew up with this awareness of women and women's empowerment. So on one level then, in that early base, there always was an interest in better rights for women from different groups. You know, so I grew up in a household where that was something that we were always interested in. In other spaces and at other times, I had different equity questions that I was interested in. So when I was in college and undergrad in Brazil, a lot of my questions were around economic and class issues. And that had to do with the context that I was living in. I lived in a hall of residence where the majority of my roommates, my fellow hallmates, were coming from some level of poverty into the university system. And we talked about class issues all the time. And then maybe my first racial awareness came from those early days in Brazil, where, you know, even in Brazil, I was often like the only Black person. So technically, I wasn't the only person of color in maybe my design program. But I think in the 5 years that I was in my industrial design program, I can remember, I can count the Black people on maybe one hand.
Yeah.
And two of us were international students. I was born, I'm old, right? So I was born in the early 70s. So it meant that, you know, around me in my childhood, people were very racially aware and very conscious of Black power and things like that. And then when I went to Brazil in the 90s, that was like the second wave of that experience for me, where it was like if I was in a second Black power movement, where the Black students on campus in where I was in Brazil, you know, were organizing and advocating for themselves. And so that was certainly another place where I learned to talk, to use this language of equity. And then the next wave would be when I came to the United States in 2015. So I've been in the States for several years now, but I don't think I am allowed to not think about race any day of my life here in the States, you know? So, I mean, this is another wave. So, I mean, there was that wave then from 2015 to 2020 when I was just here. For most of that time, I was a student and I was thinking about race on that level. That was a period where there was a lot of confrontation then between, let's say, you know, people being pulled over and shot. And, you know, there was all of this conflict between people, Black people and the police during those years. And then, of course, from 2020 to now, there's a different type of language around race and equity and so. But I haven't only been interested in race.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I have this conversation in my classroom where the students might expect me then, as a Black woman, to talk about race. And when we talk about race, sometimes I tell them, well, I'm talking about race now, but I want you to see that equity issues, they're always there. And, you know, if we can identify inequity and oppression, we should be able to see as clearly when it is about race, when it is about gender, when it is about ability, when it is about economic class, you know, the ideas that we can see that people are being treated unfairly.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually for life to get better, I know that sounds like kind of wishy-washy, but for life to get better, all of these issues have to be addressed little by little. And, you know, I also say in one of the classes that I teach that it is, in fact, a moving goalpost where, you know, once we've addressed these issues, then maybe our way of seeing the world will get a little bit clearer. And then we'll identify other issues that need to be addressed and other issues. And actually, there's an activity that I love to do with students and sometimes in design workshops where I ask people, well, after we've dealt with racism and sexism and xenophobia and everything, so in 30 years' time, what do you think we'll be dealing with?
Yeah.
And what's the inequity we'll be trying to get rid of then? And it's a hypothetical kind of conversation. But it's sometimes interesting for people to see where else might people be being pushed down that maybe we're not actually seeing today that we'll be able to see more clearly in 30 years. You know, so the example I sometimes give to start the conversation is my son is left-handed. We're very casual in how we exclude left-handed people from stuff, but maybe in 30 years' time, we'll just say that's the real cause. And we'll look back in horror at 2024, at the fact that there are so many can openers that existed that left-handed people couldn't use or something like that, right? And sometimes it's interesting to see what people propose as new things that we'll be trying to address as we're trying to seek better conditions for everybody.
Yeah, that triggered me a bit. I'm left-handed.
So I'm tell us where you feel excluded.
Yeah, what's interesting is my mother and I are the only two left-handed people in our family. But I at least had my mother, you know, growing up, where the rest of, you know, I grew up in the 90s. one of the earliest memories that I had of feeling included was my mother buying me a left-handed notebook.
Oh.
It's such a simple thing that nobody at that point thought of. And I did have all of the experiences of teachers, you know, trying to force me to write with my right hand and a lot of these different experiences that I try to forget now. But mm-hmm. I remember that, and I remember the feeling. There's a quote where it's, you don't always remember what people do or say, but you always remember how they make you feel. And that was such a pivotal moment for me because I remember, I think I cried a little bit because it was the first time that I really felt kind of seen in that spectrum where I would always, it's such a simple thing, but writing with like a traditional right-handed notebook, especially the ones with the springs, made it very difficult for me to actually start sentences and move through my exercise. And back then, this was like just before personal computers were common stream. So like everything was written, our essays were written, everything is. So I'm writing and I'm starting sometimes like it almost like a forced indent into the page. And that caused a plethora of different issues, but also it impacted my penmanship. It would change depending on where I was on the page. And writing with a pencil was horrible because I would erase my writing. All of these different things. And don't get me started on the chalkboard. I hated the chalkboard conceptually. But like when you said that of most people don't think of this. And it's, I think, a prime example of what you're talking about when it comes to like, what is inequity and what is equity and what is equitable spaces?
Yeah.
Because naturally, especially when you are a person of color and you'd mention the concept of inequity, everyone expects, to your point, expects you to talk about race. But all of these identities, reaching back to the beginning of our conversation where you talk about all of the identities and how you like kind of peel back the layers and realize that people's identities or the matrix of oppression is what I like to call it. They interact because everyone's oppression is directly linked to someone else's privilege in a way.
Yes. I mean, so many things that you said there. I wasn't always attuned to left-handed exclusion, right? So my own story about that, you know, as a mother is one day, I think we were maybe trying to get ready for school or something like that. My son was getting something to eat and we're rushing out of the house or just rushing, trying to get ready. And I asked him to open a can of tuna or something like that. I said, okay, just make yourself some tuna for breakfast. And he was already maybe about 12. And so I just put the can there and I said, okay, just open it. I'm going to go back and get ready. And then he just, you know, and I came back and he hadn't opened it. And I said, so what is wrong? Just, you know, as the mother screaming, yeah, let's get out of the house. And he says, this can opener does not work for me. And that blew my mind because here I was, this designer who's so interested in accessibility and stuff like that. And I did not even know that the can opener was right-handed. And, you know, I knew about left-handed scissors, of course, but, you know, that kind of just brought home to me that idea that of people moving through this world that looks okay, but maybe it's not, you know? And of course, as a person of color, I know this, or as a woman, I know this, but I hadn't thought about it even on like that level as a person who's left-handed or, you know, there are other oppressions or other scenarios that kind of keep people back. And so I just think that that's a skill that all of us as designers have to cultivate, where we're learning to either ask questions, look, see, try to figure out, you know, where is it that people are somehow being held back? And then how, I mean, to use the words that I just used, you know, how as designers, we could just design out that held back.
Yeah. I love so much of what you said because and throughout this entire conversation, I'm so grateful for you to join the show because one of the things that I think about is how that really kind of shows up where a lot of times we can sometimes say, oh, I didn't know. And I like to replace that with, I didn't consider. Because I actually had this interaction recently that took me back where a friend of mine, we were just out having dinner and he hadn't considered that I was left-handed until I picked up my fork. And he said, "Oh, you're left-handed." And I was like, "Yeah." And I remember him saying this so casually. he said, "But you can probably," because we were getting ready to do like a kickball thing. And he was like, "But you can probably kick with your right legs, all right." And I was like, "Yeah, I learned how to kick with my right leg." And it was so interesting because I didn't even think about it at that moment. And it was his immediate natural response of like, because we're so inclined to do what is normal for us. So everything that I learned from being ambidextrous to, because I can write for the most part with both hands. And I can, when it comes to like baseball, I learned baseball and I learned how to bat with both sides. Kickball, I learned how to kick with both sides. And I'm actually almost predominantly better with my right. And in my head, I always thought, well, experience.
Yeah.
So they said, well, just do it this way.
It was a survival mechanism for you. And so on one hand, it is a good skill, I suppose. Because it does show that you are resilient and you can figure things out. And
yeah.
But sometimes it's not, I'll say in quotes, you know, sometimes it's not so easy. Or if you think about things that the survival strategies that some people of color have to use, you know, some of this is stressful for you to have to be switching all the time. So I don't know if it's the same level of stress for you to be switching between right hand and left hand. But really, sometimes people could make life a little bit easier for you and for different people who are facing oppressions. You know, it really, that's the design question that I'm focused on right now. You know, how can we just make this experience better, easier, more peaceful for people who the experience is not designed for?
Mm-hmm.
So people who are in the majority group, the dominant group, they'll always have a good experience. But really in the design work that I'm doing, that I do, and I have to say maybe that I do from time to time because most of the design work that I do is teach.
Yeah.
But you know, some of the design consulting work that I do, I'm really always asking those questions.
I love that because my brain naturally does that. Like my brain, and I mentioned this, like I can sometimes be a contrarian. But the way that my brain processes information is to naturally question things that people think are absolute. Like when someone approaches me and goes, "This is 100% the truth, the way it works," even if it might be true, I go, "You know what? I don't know.
No.
Now I got to question this. Now I have to go do my independent research. I'm going to learn as much as I can about this topic." And then, you know, whether or not I prove it to be true or develop my own opinion on it. But my brain automatically, it just rejects some things just because other people think that they're true. And I realize that there's a whole cohort of people that do the opposite.
Yes. And so I will encourage your listeners to read the section, the recipe in the book where I talk about being intentionally oppositional. Because really being a contrarian, as you describe yourself, is important. We do need people in the world who will ask these questions from a different point of view and will sometimes be intentionally oppositional to uncover things that the rest of us are not seeing. And actually, so if we come back to my introduction, I didn't say in my introduction that I ask questions, right? And that, maybe that's part of my introduction. Actually, I'm also known for something called the Designer's Critical Alphabet. And that alphabet was really about me just asking a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I asked the questions, I'd kind of write them down and create a card around it. So the Designer's Critical Alphabet started off as being about critical theory. And how this critical theory could apply to design. It kind of morphed and it isn't quite about critical theory anymore, but it was always about trying to get designers to ask more critical questions in the work that they do. And I guess that's where I'm still professionally, that I want to ask questions. So you'll find some of the work that I'm involved in is about asking questions and trying to prompt people to think a little bit more deeply about the work that they're doing, about the experience of people who do design. Just ask a lot of questions.
Yeah, that's definitely another layer for sure. And I think it's really important to some of the conversation that we've had earlier. And I guess to close this out, I think that's a perfect segue here, is for individuals that are inspired by your work or will be, you know, after they read all of your work and they're looking to, you know, themselves to use design as a tool for social change or for really like kind of combating any of these types of systems, what advice would you offer to help them navigate both, I guess, the challenges and the opportunities in that space?
So some of the challenges in creating social change, there are few, of course, but, you know, one challenge is sometimes we think that we can do nothing, or sometimes we think that we'll be less powerful or less impactful than the reality, you know. So I guess one thing that I'd encourage people to do is do something. Figure out what is the thing you want to change, or what is the issue that you've noticed, and do something. So we were just talking about left-handedness. The issue that we might notice is that left-handed people aren't well accommodated in, well, I teach in the classroom. So the first thing I could do is maybe I'll talk about it. Second thing I'll do is take a proposal to an administrator. The idea is that there is action that we can do on any level. If my thing is graphic design and I decide, you know what, I'm going to create a poster that makes people aware of this left-handedness exclusion issue, that's another something that I'm going to do. If I am going to go out and find 10 other people who are interested in the same cause and call them all together and say, hey, let's form a group, that's the action that I'll take. But, you know, the one thing to do is to take action and make sure that you keep the momentum going.
Yeah.
Did I answer your
question? You did.
I'm not sure.
It was an open-ended question, right? Of just like, if people don't know where to start, and I think that that's amazing. If you don't know where to start, get started. Like, that's probably the best thing, is like, analytical paralysis, I think, beats most people.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because I think about this quite a bit, of the fear of change and the fear of failure will defeat more ideas than adversity ever will.
Yeah.
And I think that that's kind of what we're getting at here, of like, well, you don't have to change the world to get started, but you have to get started to change the world.
Oh, I love that. I want a t-shirt, but that says yeah, that. Yeah.
But Leslie-Ann, this has been absolutely amazing. Thank you again for joining us. I really enjoyed this. And I hope that we can continue to have this conversation.
Yes. Thank you so much for this invitation, Justin. And I look forward to other conversations in the future.